G'day, welcome back. I know, it's been a long time. Some would say we've been slack. I'd say we're just inconsistent. We're keeping you on your toes. We're surprising you with new episodes every now and then. This time, it's me and Jace back. We just spin a yarn for an hour and a half. Nothing really in particular. We cover Robert Ruach. We cover wearing in your Swanee so you don't look like you're from town. Some hunts we've been on, some hunts we haven't been on. Talk a little bit about anti-poaching stuff with rhinos, ways we could raise funds to do some better care for our native birds here. You know, who wants to go on a kiwi hunt? Maybe you do, maybe you don't. And generally spin a good yarn. We recorded this quite a while ago, but had a few technical issues and couldn't get it sorted. Finally got it sorted, so here it is. I had a lot of fun having this conversation, and I think Jace did too, and then I've actually enjoyed going back through it today and re-listening to it and going, oh shit, yeah, we talked about that. Fuck yeah. So yeah, enjoy it. Bear with us partway through. There's a little technical issue, and you get to listen to Jason talk to himself for a while, which is probably great because I talk too much anyway. So with that being said, get after it. All right, well, welcome back to episode 8 of Topographical, and Jason's back with us. How you going, bro? You all right?
Yeah, good, mate. Good to see you again.
Yeah. No, it's been a while, but we finally managed to make it work. And, hold that thought. Tell me how your day was, mate. I've got to turn off the air conditioning unit, otherwise it'll just make a racket. You know, got the heat pump going.
So we start.
We'll just keep going. That's right. Well, I thought, we're going to start with this. I was just thinking, I'm reading a new book. Well, it's an old book that I'm rereading. Robert Ruach's Use Enough Gun, which is like, I don't know. If you're going to read a hunting book in your life, this is one you should bloody read.
It's a name that rings a bell as well. I think the first time you mentioned that title was when we were on the boat to Big Curry Bay down in Stewart Island.
Yeah, possibly.
It's a good title as far as titles go.
Use Enough Gun, Robert Ruach. And he's just like an old, you know, like geezer from America that went to Africa on safaris. But yeah, I've got a section, I was just reading through it yesterday, and I thought I'd read this piece because it was just so outstanding, I guess.
Yeah, sounds good.
excuse my terrible reading, but I think this will get you a little bit excited. For a money bet, I'll shoot a tiger and kill him with a 22 Hornet if I'm high in a tree. For practical purposes, a 30-06 is plenty. For my personal purposes, on anything that can kick me, bite me, claw me, or trample me, I use a Wesley Richards 470 double-barreled express rifle. I notice that most pros use too much gun, and what's good enough for the pros is good enough for the amateurs. Both of your feet, and then he goes on to talk about sitting in a tree, getting ready to hunt, or during a tiger hunt in India. Both of your feet are asleep, and a fly is crawling in one nostril and the other is investigating your lips. A couple of barking deer does have jumped out of the bushes, scaring you to death, and a huge male peacock, his breast brilliant blue, his tail as long as a log, has squawked and flown right over your head. You are quivering gently inside and sweating at the palms, and if you've checked the safety on the 470 once, you've checked it 100 times. You know everything there is to know about tigers. All of a swift sudden, you hear a roar that makes a lion's best sound effort look Sorry, I'll start that again then. All of a swift sudden you hear a roar that makes a lion's best effort sound like a canary with a croup. You hear the hurried clap clap of the stoppers and you are looking for a big tiger, proud, slow, arrogant, cautious, to walk out to you and under so that you can shoot him in the back of the neck, the way Charlie Vaughan did the other day, off on his beat down the road. And what you get is a teal, a blue-winged teal, coming downwind, except this teal is 9 feet 11 inches long, is striped black on a golden hide, has teeth as long as railroad spikes, has a ruff that stands out from his face like a misdirected white halo, has an old wound on his left hind leg, is making jumps of better than 20 feet, and is roaring as if somebody scolded him. I was unprepared for this activity. They told me tigers always came quietly. Well, a duck hunter is a duck hunter, a quail shot is a quail shot, and while I don't know much about rifles, a double is a double, and a flying bird is a flying bird. I wing shot this teal, this tiger, in the middle of a jump that carried him higher than the macan. I led him 4 feet and busted his shoulder, and down he came like a four-motored aircraft and spun on his tail as if he was a maypole. I walloped him again in the somewhere, and he quit, about 8 feet from the tree in which the macan was tied. I looked at Mama, and you could have scraped her eyes off with spoons. I tried to light a cigarette and couldn't. My hands were shaking like a Macarena player's in a Cuban dance band. God almighty. Isn't that just outstanding writing?
That's unbelievable, eh?
Like, I was talking to a mate the other day, and he was reading some book about seeker hunting, and he was disgusted in the just like terrible language that the guy had for describe, like the way he was describing his stalk to get the seeker. There was like no like romance to the writing at all. And then you read this and it's like, fuck yeah.
Yeah, there's a reason stuff like that stands the test of time.
Exactly. It's bloody good. But yeah,
It's
no, that's
outrageous. When just give us a bit of background on that book. Do you know how old it is, or?
you know what? I'm gonna look on the front of the book and find out.
You know, and are they, is that like a drive for the tiger?
Oh yeah, he does go on to talk about this. So this was first published in Great Britain in 1967.
Oh yeah, it's good old
So
days.
I'd say that the hunting is this is during the 50s and 60s or something. But yeah, oh yeah, the tiger drive. That whole chapter actually goes on to talk about tiger hunting and how it's easy as all fuck. And there's two ways to kill a tiger. You either shoot them on a bait, or you shoot them on a beat,
Oh yeah,
and
that makes sense.
that was it. And you sit in a blind. In that part, I really talks about how the tiger jumped higher than the macan. The macan is like his little blind he's made in a tree, and his little tree stand thing.
Fuck,
Yeah.
imagine, eh?
Oh, just
Like
huge critter.
you've got so much of the upper hand. You
Yeah.
know, like it's running through the forest, not worrying about you, worrying about the beaters. But even then,
It's a
it's a
fucking
frightening
tiger,
little
bro.
scenario.
He starts the chapter with, "A dead tiger is the biggest thing I have ever seen in my life, and I've shot an elephant. A live tiger is the most exciting thing I've ever seen in my life, and I've shot a lion." And he just goes on and on about how just ridiculous. "A wild tiger is the most frightening thing I've seen in my life, and I've shot Cape Buffalo." Like, they
Yeah.
just sound like they are, you know, I've seen them at the zoo, which ain't the wild, but you know, they're fucking huge.
Yeah. And you think about how athletic a house cat is,
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
and
And this
like,
is like a 1 ton house cat.
yeah, that like fights for a living.
And is sneaky for a living. Like,
Yeah, like the house
Like,
cat, if the house cat's not sharp on its skills, it doesn't really matter. It still gets fed at the end of the day.
whereas this tiger is literally the top of the food chain.
Yeah.
Second only to the Wesleyan Richards 470 double
How big's
X-ray
that?
Nitro
How
Express.
much bigger than like a 0.3 is that? It,
Well,
it,
it's 0.4,
yeah, is that what
1.7.
it means? No, but is
So
it like,
that's,
that's the like caliber, but is it big boogie? You know, like a big case behind it? I've
oh
never heard of
yeah,
that round before.
the thing's like, I don't even know how to explain them. It's a big fucking finger.
So it's just massive round.
They're freaking huge. I'd love to shoot one.
Do they use them over in the States on like the on beer and stuff?
Nah, it's a real, well, I don't know, someone probably does, but it's a real African round. It's a safari round, and you have the likes of like the Wesleyan Richards who were or are like the premier gun. If you're gonna buy like a Wesleyan Richards drop lock double rifle, you're looking at a like you're it's gonna cost you your whole year's wage easily. And then I think you probably can't like to buy one brand new, you'd probably have to get on a very long waiting list, and to buy one second hand, they probably cost even more. Like, yeah,
Just
like
the
there's some
Rolex of
of
guns.
those. Yeah, it's phenomenal type. Yeah, it'd be awesome to have, but
I rate that it's like a double barrel, like rifle. You know, and this is like post-war. We know there's much more tech out, you know.
Yeah, well, the idea of them was more like simplicity and reliability. Like, a lot of them are so simple you could strip them down in the field. So the idea being they're built in London, and then, so your prince of bloody whatever or whoever he is, orders one of these and goes on his big safari, takes his double rifle, or the professional hunter, the PH over in Africa, has this double rifle or whatever, and if something happens to it while they're on safari, it's all good. Like, you can just fix it with a pair of pliers and a couple of spare parts kind of thing. You're not sending, because they were like designed around a time where you couldn't just like jump it on NZ Post overnight and whip it off to get repaired and bring it back. Like, you're 6 months from the nearest gunsmith. So they're real basic, but awesome. I don't know. I just think they're so cool. I really want to buy some of those sort of old rifles, doubles, and yeah, that'd be cool.
That'll be. I love your the single you've got. That's it just makes you respect your shot.
It's very cool. Yeah. So that's a Martini Enfield 303.
You've done pretty well with that, because where are you at now with the species list of big game species of New Zealand? Is that, are you square
So
with your
yeah,
normal
with
rifle?
that, What if I, yeah, no, I did, because I did a year hunting with it, and then, so it's a Martini Enfield single shot 303, and I did a year of hunting with just that, just to kind of see, one, just to be like, this would be cool to hunt just with this, because it's fucking cool, but also just to sit, to like kind of prove to myself that like, you don't need all this fancy pants bullshit. Like, you can get it all done. And yeah, I did. I shot tar, goats, deer, pigs. I did not get a chamois, but I have not shot a decent chamois regardless anyway. So, yeah, but
How close do you have to get?
Reds.
Like it.
Oh,
that's
it's
one of the
not.
cooler lures, I reckon, is it's like you gotta get right in the zone.
Yeah,
so like getting
I
a par
had.
with one is so cool.
Yeah, I shot the
like
tar
bow
shot
hunting.
was at 90 meters, but I lined up on a ball at 150 meters and didn't shoot because I couldn't.
For context, it's open sight. It's just got
And the front sight was like as big as the whole fucking tar at 150, and I was like, there's no precision in this shot. Like I could quite easily be just shooting nowhere near where I need to be shooting on this thing. So I left that, and then got one at 90, and I was like, well, it's a long shot, but had a real, it was nice rest. It was cool. That was fucking cool actually, because it was a real old, it was like an 11 year old bull. It was only like 10 and a half inches long. It was pretty sweet.
Cool ones to get.
Yeah.
It's good to get the gun out on tour. I remember when we did the raft trip down the Waimak through the gorge.
Yeah.
You know? And
yeah, and that's the other, that's the other cool thing about it, is that like there's no, it's already had the shit beaten out of it well and truly before I got it. And then I just keep beating the shit out of it in like a respectful way, but like I don't have to, you just strap it on the raft and go down the river. You're not worried about it. Whereas like you take something else and you're worrying about bumping the scope and fucking scratching this and bending that and whatever. And you just slap this thing on and just go.
Yeah. I find like every scratch is kind of something to it now as well. It's got that mosaic of, I found like when I got my shotgun, the first scratch just hurt so much.
Yeah.
You know, but then, you know, the second one hurts a little less. And by the time you get to 3 and 4 and 5, it starts to add to it quite a bit.
Yeah.
You know?
And then it starts cool. to tell, like, telling stories kind of thing.
Yeah. And I love looking at one of the guys I, like, hunt down south with. And he's had his shotgun for, God, like, at least 30 years.
Yeah.
And it is so beaten, but just such a cool old side by side.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and it just has so many nicks and chips and scratches, and it's seen some shit.
Yeah. It's bloody cool. It's like Dad's got a Winchester Model 94 44 mag lever action, you know, with the short barrel and everything. And
is that
one
he takes out pig hunting?
Yeah. I think you've definitely seen that one. But it's around, like, the action. You know, if you're, like, carrying a rifle in one hand beside you, like, you, there's a balance point where you grab it. Like, on my 2-3 Tika with the barrel cut off it and everything, it's you grab right on the magazine, and that's, like, the balance point, the way it's set up. On the 44... that like point of carry is right on the action, and the action was blued, and now it's just this like polished metal where your hand has just been rubbing on it forever and a day.
Yeah, that's so good, eh?
Yeah.
I used to love that. This is slightly unrelated, but when I was, you know, like traveling around Europe and you visit the temples, and as everyone goes around the corner of a old, you know, castle or whatever.
Yeah.
And they put their hands on the same cornerstone as they go around.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that castle's been there for a couple of hundred years, and people have been walking around that corner and putting their hand there for a couple of hundred years. And so it's all rough rock, and then there'll just be this hand-sized patch.
Smooth patch.
Yeah, that's just polished smooth.
Which is just
unbelievable that, you know, the passage of like soft shoes will hollow out a step, or if you poke something enough times, you'll turn.
It'll bend. I think that's amazing, because there's a tree, there's a tree in Canada. There's a fuckload of trees in Canada. There's probably a lot of trees similar to this one, but at this spot that I guided at when I was working for Sickney River, we there's a tree there, and there's grizzly bear footprints leading up to this tree that are like the closest ones to the tree are probably 3 inches deep, like indentations in the ground. And it's just where bears or multiple bears over however many years have walked up to this tree, stepped in the same spots, turned around, and then like scratched their back all over the tree or whatever they do. But there's like the footprints leading up to it. And every time I
That's
saw that,
insane, eh?
yeah, because that's like a spot I went back to a few times and just it always blew my mind. And to see that like same principle at when you think about that, like largely, you know, with like the way you wear out a rifle or the way you wear out the cornerstone on an old temple, like I don't know, that's just cool, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's
Yeah.
amazing that, you just like such a small impact cumulatively can have such a lasting kind of impact on it, impression.
Yeah.
That's cool
Yeah.
to see. Yeah, and it's the coolest on like old tools or old knives and all that kind of stuff. Like I love seeing a knife that you look at it and you can tell that has been sharpened many, many, many times. That it's so,
Something
the
that's
silhouette
worn
of it is
down.
just so distinctly different from what it originally was.
Yeah. Like if you see an old shepherd with his, you know, like your classic Kiwi shepherd's knife, and instead of having that like nice round to it or a nice bulbous end, it's just kind of like worn, skinny and flattish, and it's,
Yeah.
you know, like just, yeah.
I think Barry Crumb talked about in one of his books. He like I can't remember what it was, which book it was, but he described this guy as having a knife that was worn down to a spike.
Yeah.
And it's like just classic, eh? You could
Yeah.
just immediately picture it. I think it's
I've
Barry
got
Crumb, I
a
can't remember.
I've got a old Makita, and it was like the first knife I ever got. German Makitas, which is gotta be close to one of the best knives ever made, but
People swear by them, eh?
oh yeah, they're gold. But my one, like I remember as a kid always seeing dads, and he had a couple, and they were all like they'd been sharpened down to needles from his time possuming when he was just skinning possums all the time, you know. You're just wearing out knives. And I'd like just never worn out a knife that much until I got back from doing a couple of seasons guiding, and all of a sudden you're doing heaps of head skins, and especially when you go on to the big stuff like the bison, where there's a lot of knife work, and a lot of it was done in the dark, half drunk when it comes to the bison. So we're often, you know, you're running your knife on things you shouldn't run a nice sharp knife, and so it's going blunt quicker than it needs to, and you're putting it on the stone a heap more. And then so now I look at my Makita and it's like worn down. The blade is not the shape it originally was, and you look at it and you go, fuck, that's there's some yarns there. And it just makes you think back to those times of like sinking bears and skinning bison and things like that.
Yeah, that's so true. And it's just like, it's one of those things you can't buy. Like you can't buy a worn out. I met this dude who was he was the Auckland Council deer killer. Because Auckland has an encroaching deer problem. But he was a really interesting guy, and he had done a whole bunch of conservation work around New Zealand, and on one of the jobs he was doing, they were trapping. So down off the bottom of the Chathams, there's Chatham Island, and then another smaller one, and then another smaller one off the south coast of that, and they were down there trying to find. There's like a species of robin that got pushed all the way off to these like smaller islands. If that makes sense. Just get my maps. Yeah, so there's the Chathams and then Pitt. And then this other Southeast Island. And so this the Pitt Island robin was apparently like only left on the small Southeast Island. And they were there trying to like catch a few of them to protect them. And yeah, definitely don't fact check me here, but anyway, they're down there, and so he was there. There was one other ranger. He was a ranger for Doc, and then there was like a kind of he said he was like a kind of head honcho guy from Doc, who was usually based out of the Christchurch office, like a bit more of an office management type. And so they were all there catching robins, and what they'd do is they'd set up these nets in the forest and then play like robin calls, and then the robins that territorial would come and like fly into the nets and get caught, and be able to do their
Take them with them.
do their banding or whatever they were doing. Anyway, they'd get bored because they're doing this day after day, and they'd go and sneak up on the other guys and play robin calls back at them to get them fired up. And so anyway, he went over and picked up the other ranger from the Chathams, and they decided they'd go to, play a game on the guy from Christchurch. And they snuck over there, and as they kind of came through the bush and they saw where he was, they could see him just going back and forward about over a kind of meter and a half space. But he was just like walking back and forth, and they're watching him and like, what the fuck's this guy doing? And so they sneak up a bit more, sneak up a bit more, and then eventually they get, quite close, and they're like, what the fuck is he doing? And they call out, they call out to him. He's like, what are you doing? And they walk over, and he had his swan dry on the ground, and he was trampling it into the dirt because, and he later explained that he had been self-conscious about how crisp his swan dry looked compared to these two guys who were dock rangers on the Chathams, who obviously their swan dries looked the business. And it's just like,
Wanting to look the part, that authenticity that you cannot, there's no shortcut to
you can't buy it. If you
it.
buy a swan dry, you're just not gonna, like there's only one way to make a swan dry look, to look like it's been in the bush, and that's to wear it in the bush for a bit. And th that's the same with the knife. It's like there's only one chance you get. There's no shortcuts there. You just have to sharpen your knife a lot.
And use it. Yeah,
Yeah,
exactly.
exactly.
Oh, what a fool.
Yeah, but I've always thought about it, and I have a because let's be fair, swan dries are great garments, but they're just pigs of things in the bush.
Oh,
And
God.
so it's, like I have one, but then you quickly realize that there's a lot better stuff to be wearing.
So you just end up with this immaculate swan dry.
Yeah, so I just have the swan dry that just doesn't look. I think I need to wear it on a few more rock fishing
Oh.
missions or something to.
I hope I don't ever find you just standing in the backyard stomping on the
Now that I'm like aware of, I'm too like cognizant of the whole process, so I just I'm too aware that that would just be outright cheating, and you can't cheat these things, Bruce.
No, you cannot cheat these things. Speaking of another thing you cannot cheat, not last episode, so last episode was with trout. The episode four was with a cousin of mine, Sean Alexander, episode number six. If you haven't listened to it, you should. And Sean's guy, he's at Lincoln Uni, and he's in the Lincoln University Hunting Club, which is like quite a big hunting club. And we ended up talking about the hunting club and whatnot. It seems like a pretty cool thing. If you're at Lincoln Uni or thinking of going there, you should definitely, Google them or whatever. But after that, I had a guy message me on the Instagram saying cool episode. Oh no, he didn't even say cool episode. He just seen me post about it and it said, oh, did you like talk to them about shooting heaps of young animals? And I was like, oh, I didn't. And then I was like, oh, and I went back through a heap of photos. And man, they're cleaning up some young bulls. Like, holy shit. Like, I get it. There's a bunch of young kids. Like, there's probably heaps of dudes doing their first hunts. But, like, you see some photos and they'd be like, well, over 10, maybe 20 tar, and they all look like young animals. And I just thought, like, we harp on about, like, herd management and stuff like that. Like, this is a discussion me and you have like all the time. And then I didn't even really like discuss that with Sean, and I was like, fuck, I really should have. And
It's
then
interesting though.
to get called out about it, and I was like, you know what, that's a fucking good thing. We should call each other out about that sort of stuff and be like, oi, what are you doing? So Sean and the rest of the hunting club, oi, what are you doing? Let them grow. And yeah.
I'll come at that from the other side though. I reckon, there's a I totally agree that being selective is a great thing. But there's also for like people starting in the sport, and this is one of
Oh,
the things that
yeah.
I thought was awesome. Because that was a cool story, and the fact that they have all that gear for hire and stuff through the club.
Yeah,
I was listening to that and
very
I was
cool.
thinking, and it kind of reflected. Because remember, I bought my that 7 mil off you midway through uni, and then I had the 7 mil. I was like, oh, I mean, I don't have a sleeping bag, I don't have a tent, I don't have a cooker, I don't have any idea. And so even like through the I try to go out but would just
Really?
have no idea. So I was thinking as I was listening to that, I was like, God, that's
You've
such
appeared
a
to have
great
lost
like
Jason.
initiative to kind of get people into the sport. And I'd definitely say that, there's a massive advantage of kind of letting people have a bit of extra rope when they're early on. Because it like gets them hooked into it, It like helps people get kind of started and get hooked on the sport, and then once I've shot a few, then it's like, okay,
You
mate, you've
be
got a
right.
few now you can start
No.
to wisen up. It's like me, I've never shot a bull tar, and I'm probably going to shoot the first tar I see. Lost Bruce. I can't hear you if you're still on there.
Yo, I have no
Yo.
idea what happened there. Just my in the whole internet just cut out for a few minutes and now it's going again.
Oh, it's all
Oh.
good. Where are you, up north or are you
Now I'm out
down country?
between Danny Virk and Herbertville at a job. So, yeah.
How far through my monologue on new entrants to Hunters were
Somewhere, we'll just back it right up to you start again on your monologue. You're talking about how you when you started, you bought that 7 mil 08 off me, and then you were a broke uni student, and you actually didn't have enough money to do anything else. You sat around for a while just with a rifle.
Yeah. How does this work? You just knit this all together.
Yeah, pretty much.
Oh, yeah, sweet.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because I think when I bought that rifle, the 7mm 08 off you, you know, I've had all these grand ideas of getting into hunting and stuff, but then bought that, didn't have a sleeping bag, had a pair of boots, fortunately, didn't have a tent, didn't have a cooker, didn't have any idea. And, you know, so it was pretty tough to kind of get into it. So I kind of sympathize with these guys getting out there.
And, yeah, definitely. And, like, I think what myself and the guy I was talking to about were really meaning was, like, just having, like, even with new guys, like, more people need to be having that discussion on, like, letting young bulls go so that big bulls exist at some point. You know, like, you'll...
Yeah, or shoot a nanny or
something. Yeah, shooting nannies and really...
If you want to get one on the board.
Yeah, or if you really want to, like, just... If you just want to go out there and kill shit, like, there's plenty of places where you just go and shoot heaps of nannies, and it, you know. But...
And you're kind of doing the whole thing. It's amazing how much that's changed in the... Because it feels like a pretty recent shift. And I don't know what your take on it is, but it feels like, you know, it's all kind of happened in the last 5 years. Maybe slightly more.
The shift to...
This whole shift.
Older animals and sort of better herd management.
Breed up. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, probably.
I think there's that great video from Cam Speedy on it. You know, which has probably set the pace a fair bit about herd management. But it makes so much sense to kind of manage population by managing hinds. And you never get an 8-year-old stag if you shoot them when they're 6 or 5.
Yeah, exactly. There's...
And I always think about, like, you know, everyone wants something beautiful for the wall. But if you shoot something that's not quite wall standard, because you're only going to put one on the wall, or maybe another, maybe one or two, you know, but you're not going to have 10 on the wall unless you're on one of these. Maybe
two weekends ago or something, or last weekend I was in a mate's place and he's probably got more than 10 seeker on the wall. But he's a dirty old bastard, so... Yeah, is just Googling at that. Sorry. Most people of same mind would not fill their place with.
Well, most people aren't going to shoot 10 wall hangers in a lifetime.
No,
you know, like most people are going to shoot one, maybe two wall hangers in a lifetime.
Yeah.
But then if you're shooting a whole bunch of, if you shoot one every year, but they're not a wall hanger, then... I know this term's probably a bit confusing, but I'd call it like a shed head. You know, it's just like, it's not something you're going to put on your wall. And so you just stick it in the shed.
Yeah. And if you're, and if so you are like, shooting a tar every, let's say you are shooting one every year, if you shoot that 6-year-old now, 4 years from now when he's 10, if you hadn't shot him, you might be shooting a 10-year-old bull now, but now you're not because you shot him 4 years ago and he never got the chance to get there. And so you probably just shoot another young
and
one.
And then that like 6-year-old head's like nothing essentially.
And
like it was
and even if he goes 12 and a half inches or something, they still don't quite look like, you know, say he's a 6-year-old bull and he goes 12 inches or something. Because he's a monster, he's got big tips or whatever. But then, how fucking cool would it have looked as a 10 or 11-year-old bull? And it wouldn't have grown that much more, but there'll be a few more inches there, you know? And just all those age rings stacked up, they look so much more impressive.
Yeah. And that's the thing, you know, it's like if it's good, but not quite good enough to go on the wall, then you know, it's just wasted. Like, you're going to throw that in the shed, it's going to sit there and gather dust, and then eventually you'll be like, oh, I need to clear some space out and chuck that in the bin.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You know, there's just no value. I wonder if there's like a, you know, a sweet spot of kind of antler length by age, where like it grows quickly, and then past like a certain age, they're kind of, they start, you know, brushing them off and that kind of thing.
Oh, you mean horn length?
Do you know what I mean?
Sorry, yeah, when you said antler length, I started thinking about stag. So horn, so there's like a...
Oh, it's because I'm a rookie. I just use those interchangeably.
Yeah. So what are you saying? Like
it, not a professional. Grows
to, like, say by 5 years old, you should be able to look at his horn and make a very good judgment of what he's going to be.
No, what I mean is, like, so as a young animal, because how does, like, when the antler gets, not antler, the horn gets brushed, is that, like, just through the passage through monkey scrub, they kind of scrape off the lamb tips? Is that how that works?
So, well, firstly, I'll say I am far from an expert at this. But my understanding is that it's not so much as it's not that through the passage of walking through the scrub, it's they literally will go and like thrash up on shit, and rub on trees. And a lot of horned animals do this, like you notice this a lot, with the bison that we hunted in Canada, and you'd get old as bulls and they wouldn't have that much horn because it's all worn down, it's all rubbed down. And I think that's the same setup that the Tara have, and they're wearing it down just by rubbing it on. Like, you even see them just bashing up a piece of tussock on the ground, and I guess they just do that much of it, they just wear the shit out, and then they're, you know, a bit of cracking, like, and chipping off through fighting and stuff. Yeah, full circle back. If you use your knife, it'll wear out. Yeah.
Because what I'm getting at is, if there, you know, there must be a point in a tar's life where the growth rate is kind of being superseded by the destruction rate of them thrashing up on stuff.
Yeah,
you know, so it's getting longer because it's growing faster than they beat up tussock and wear their horns out beating up tussock. But then there comes a point where it starts to go backwards again.
Yeah, it's not, you know, growing fast enough to keep up with the rate of the destruction.
Yeah, they grow kind of 4 mil a year, but they're rubbing off 5 mil. So they're going backwards a mil a year kind of thing. I wonder, like, where that...
I guess that's what happens. I don't know if anyone's ever... No, I guarantee there'll be someone who's got that data. There'll be someone to be able to tell you that. Give you a definitive answer there. It ain't me.
I wonder, you know, I wonder if, like, the sweet spot for antler length tar might be slightly younger than old. Yep. Old. You know? Because how old do they get, you reckon?
Well, so I've shot a 10 and a couple of 11-year-olds. I believe I've seen a few like 12, 13-year-olds. And years ago, Baden McNabb shot a 17-year-old, I believe 14-inch bull, and I think it was somewhere in the Rangitata. I'll be able to check that. I think there's a picture of that on Todd's Instagram or something. Someone will know. But yeah, I believe it was like a 17-year-old bull, and it was old as shit, like worn the fuck down teeth. But then even that, like, I shot a 10-year-old bull at the end of the rut, and he was skin and bones, teeth worn right down. like who's worn right out and ugly. Like, I don't know, to make it to 17, you have to be a tough old bastard because they live through some hard shit and they look like you get a bull over 10 years old and they often in a rough condition.
Yeah.
Yeah, so who knows?
Death by bullet's not the worst outcome for them.
Nah, I'd say oftentimes death by bullet's best option. Yeah. Like, you imagine you're just out quicker. Cruising, having a good time, and then it's over.
Especially if you're starting to get to the point where you can't chew your grass
up anymore. And it happens in the rut, so you've just got your shag on. You're looking mean with your big flow, waving in the wind. And you just get wrecked by 180 grains of lead. Boom, lights out. That sounds way better than starving to death. I'll take that one every fucking day of the week.
Speaking of tar trips, how was the recent? Did you make it down this year?
Yep, so we went into Tickleman Creek early on, maybe second period. We had a bit of a shitty weather forecast and we were tossing up what to do, and we thought, nah, you know what?
Whether to go on.
Yeah, we were thinking about going East Coast and what, and we thought, nah, you know, you don't get to draw one of these every year. You don't get to go, like, you could never draw that specific block again, you know, you for whatever reason. If you're trying to go into heaps of different blocks, you just might not get back to that one. So we're like, fuck it, let's go. Who cares? If we only get 2 days of hunting weather, it'll be worth it. And so we go over there and we fly in, and we got in 2 days of hunting, I think, and then we should have flown out on the Monday afternoon, but we were like, nah, weather looks mean, we're going to get a weather window, we've got some shit weather for a bit, and then we're going to get a window, and we stuck it out for another night, and then we got another weather update the next morning, and we were like, oh, fuck this. And I'm glad we got out because it just got worse and worse. We only just made it out of there.
What was it? Just rain
just
and wind?
Just rain and wind. Not even like super cold, just, you know, just miserable. And we got out and the chopper guys were like, yeah, you guys are fucking idiots. Everybody else left their blocks yesterday. And we were like, oh,
it doesn't surprise me at all.
Just a bunch of idiots just trying to frothing too hard. So we ended up not shooting anything. We've seen a good number of bulls. From what we saw, didn't seem to be an excessive amount of tar in that block, which is good because some of the other blocks I've been in, you're going, holy shit, numbers need to drop in here. But that was there. Yeah, we've seen a heap of nannies here and there, heap of bulls, but all young or small, you know, nothing that we had deemed to be big enough. But in saying that, we'd only had sort of two good evenings of watching, two good mornings, two good evenings of looking for them. So there could have been something there by the end of the week. I think the guys before us shot some nice bulls. So we pulled out of there early, whipped over to the East Coast and went into an old deer spot and cleaned up, shot a bunch of deer and walked out of there with a heap of meat. So the boys are happy.
Yeah, it makes a triple work,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Yeah. No, it's pretty good.
How many different blocks have you done on the coast
now? I've only done three. So Tickleman Creek this year, last year Jacobs, and the year before the Edison. And that's it. Those are the only years I've put in to go and I got them. So that was pretty cool. But I think the goal is to try and do every block. like just over my lifetime.
Yeah,
That'd be,
that's such a
yeah,
good
that'd
goal.
just be really cool to have gone to every block and just had a good look around. Like, even if you don't shoot shit, like, it's just cool country. And
Yeah, exactly.
like, it's not often, well, it's never that you get the chance to land a helicopter in there. So, you know, it's pretty neat stuff. What trips are you been up to? Like, how'd your raw go? How'd your duck shooting season go so far? You're still working pheasants and ducks, and what's been happening there?
Yeah, the I'll start with the raw. Raw was I found a bit fickle up where we go, which is kind of central North Island. But yeah, it's they kind of I went for probably 5 weekends in a row. And had kind of one good weekend out of that where they were going. Otherwise, yeah, it was just quite tough to get much action out of them. But had a really cool encounter with a younger stag. It was like a little 8-pointer. But yeah, I mean, I'm pretty new to the whole thing, and so I hadn't actually had a kind of genuine
Up close,
raw
raw.
experience before, and so it was pretty awesome to kind of raw this guy in. And I kind of roared from the bottom of this little valley and heard him at the top, and then he just kind of kept going by himself, so I was stalking up with the dog. And yeah, and then I kind of saw him for the first time, saw him thrashing a punga.
Oh, yeah.
So saw the punga moving, and then eventually saw him, and then got a glimpse of his head, and realized he wasn't gonna
Wasn't big enough.
realized he was a shed filler, but not a wall hanger. But yeah, and then so I just kind of stood there, and I put the dog on it on a stop, and he just kept coming. And I had given a little kind of hind call. And he just came right in. I've got this real cool little video of him coming into,
Real close.
like 10 meters or less.
It's so cool, eh?
Yeah, unbelievable. And I think I read somewhere that, the moment you pull the trigger, the moment ends, and it changes from that point on. But when you don't, then so much more can happen after that point
Because
in
you'll
time.
often
That would never happen.
you'll often shoot something that is like if something, if you get a shot within 100 meters, you'll often be shooting, you know? Whereas if you're
Yeah,
running
exactly.
just the camera or you're just simply taking it as it comes, shit will come right in, less than 10 meters, it's right in there in your face, you know? You shoot 5 meters away and you're like, holy crap. And then it might.
Yeah, it was like to the point it's like, fuck, how close is this guy gonna come? Like, I'm gonna be wearing this guy soon. Which is pretty cool.
So cool. So cool.
Yeah, so he obviously scampered away, and then that was kind of the best action I got for the raw. But yeah, we'll settle up again for next year. And it was good getting the dog out. And then, yeah, for opening weekend, we were down on a mate's farm that has a couple of ponds, but they're reasonably new and not on like a flight line or anything. But they get a few ducks. But yeah, we just kind of sat there for the morning, and zero ducks came by.
Mean.
Mean, yeah. But again, I'm like easily pleased because I'm so new to all of this that, any small shred of action is a massive. It's like when you're 5 years old, every year feels like a massive amount of time, because it's such a, it represents such a large increment on your previous experience. Yes.
Like as a percentage, whereas, of you know, your life, it takes up a large chunk, yeah, compared, exactly, to like a 60-year-old. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, like as we're like getting older, each new year represents a decreasing increment,
yep,
on your, yep, life. And so like each new year kind of feels less full on and new. And so like me as a very early stage hunter, I get just so much froth from very little,
yeah,
because I haven't experienced, yep, a whole lot. And it's like such a blissful, I'm so aware of it. And it's such a blissful place to be, because really not a lot has to happen for me to be quite a happy, yep, camper.
Isn't that just the joy of doing anything new, that like the, yeah, slightest, yeah, little, true, things are just amazing.
Yeah. Which it's, yeah, it's nice, right? So anyway, opening morning was pretty quiet, but that was cool because we just kind of hung out and yarned and enjoyed that. And then we went to jump shoot a pond on the neighbor's place, which we were sure had ducks, yeah, on it. And so as we snuck around, we were coming up, and you could sneak up kind of below the dam, yeah, on this pond, and then you'd pop up onto the dam. Everything's right there. Seemed like a great plan. But when we kind of came around the little knoll, and we're about to sneak up the creek up towards the dam,
yeah,
there were two parries, yeah, sitting on the hill above the pond. And yeah, it's just like there's no win here.
They suck, eh?
You know, we were creeping. They do suck. Like, they were too far away for us to have a go at them. But they were just like, they started chirping as soon as we came around the corner. And we were out of sight because we're below the like surface of the rim of, yeah, the dam. So whatever's on the pond can't, yeah, see us. But these two geezers sitting up on the grass above the pond could definitely see us. And so, yeah, as we crept forward, they chirped and then chirped more and then chirped more. And then probably a dozen mallards got off the dam while we were still out of range.
Oh, yeah.
So that was attempt number two. Thwarted.
Sounds like a real successful day.
Yeah, and then that was the morning. And then in the afternoon, we got invited to another farm down the road, which had like a really well-established pond on it, and they'd been shooting ducks all morning, and were starting to slow down, but there was still ducks. Like everyone had kind of had their, I wouldn't say their fill, but they'd kind of whetted their appetite, yeah, a little bit, and so they invited us down, and I shot my first confirmed mallard on that pond, which was nice. Sick.
Well done.
You know, and no one else shot at it, so I know,
yeah,
I got it.
Yeah.
And it was satisfying as all hell.
Oh, that's bloody cool. With the dog?
You just get the most instant.
Was Monty with
you? Yeah, and then Monty ran some real good, yeah, retrieves.
Mean.
I didn't take him down on Saturday because I kind of didn't want to have to worry about him, and I knew there'd be other dogs, yeah, there. So, you know, it's not like he was required. But we went back on Sunday morning and picked up another few ducks.
Oh, man.
And it was just me and my mate that time. And Monty was the only, yep, dog. And, yeah, it was mint getting him doing some good retrieves.
Yeah, that's bloody cool, eh?
Because, yeah, he hasn't done much kind of retrieving over water. It's just been upland stuff.
Bloody good.
Which is good, so... Yeah, that's been the extent of my recent, yep, hunting. There's also a foray after some pigs over on Great Barrier, but they gave me a slip.
Oh, that's the goods, eh? That's the goods. I got out for a harpooker fishing experience recently. With some mates back up north, so I headed up to mum and dad's a couple of weekends ago, and catch up with them, and the boys like, oh, the weather's looking mint, so we'll head out off the west coast, out off the Hokianga Harbour, which I was like, sweet, because I grew up on the west coast there and had never been out of the Hokianga, so I was like, this is going to be cool, like, go out here and go deep water fishing for harpooker, never done that, like, fuck yeah, it's all on. The boys are talking up a massive game about how good they were, how they always catch fish, and I'm just frothing, the weather's mint, it's like flat as, we get over there, nice early start, get out there, you know, catching heap of live baits at the wharf, going, fuck yeah, this is mean, and there's supposed to be two boats go out as well, and one of the boats was going to be a bit late, so four of us piled onto one boat, and there's only two on the other boat, because they were a couple of hours late, So our boat had like electric reels, which apparently, you know, you definitely need that for that deep water fishing. So, and our boat had a sonar and all of this fancy tech, right? And we got up earlier as well, which has to count for points. And we head out like something like 20 Ks just west. Like you just go.
Just like pointed towards Sydney and squeezed the
bit. Yeah. So we're like. We crossed the bar in the morning. We waited in the harbour till the sun came up, but it was so foggy it didn't matter anyway. Just like a thick fog.
How was the bar?
Well, I didn't even realise we'd gone across it. Tom just turned around and he goes, oh, yeah, we're through it. I'm like, oh, sweet. So it was just like real flat, which was lucky because we couldn't see shit. We pretty much idled across the bar because you just couldn't fucking see anything. Anyway, we get out.
Wow.
And I just sort of went south a little bit till we got out of the fog. And it was actually really cool. The fog was kind of coming like down the river, down the harbour, and then just shooting straight out west. And it literally in a straight line just went west out of the mouth. And there was just a wall of fog. It was actually pretty cool to look at
for most of the
morning. But yeah, we just went out there and. We just went west for like 20 Ks until we're in 328 meters of water. And there was like a little, like a ride. It went from like 328 down to 331 or something. Like just, you know, there's just like a little rise in the ground floor. And they're like, there'll be fish here. And I'm like, how the fuck do you know that? And So we go to start fishing and you like drop the reel down, like you drop the bait down the way you usually would. And then you've got, it's like electric reels for winding it up. And I was like, oh, that kind of seems lame. Like you got to wind it up by hand. Well, fuck, I wound one up by hand, eh? And it sucks. I see why everyone uses the electric shit. Like I think for your first one, you should wind it up by hand. But,
just so you appreciate
it. Yeah, but. It's not like
how long would it take by hand? Like 5 minutes?
Probably longer. I don't know. It seemed like a long time, but you weren't. So, well, hold on. Let me just premise this. I didn't actually catch a single harpooker myself, nor did we, any of us, catch like a big fucker. But my understanding is they don't really fight. They just. Like, you know, if you're catching kingies on a jig or on a stick bait or something, like, you're actually working the rod and you're fighting with this fish and there's, like, there's manipulation of the rod and of the tip and just the tip and of wind, you know, like, you're working the drag and you're winding. And with this, like, the thing's just in the side and you press the fucking button and it just goes, it's like a winching a log off the road with your truck. Like,
yeah, and you just
wind it up, and then it just before the surface it stops, and then you like hand wind the last little bit. And I caught a heap of sharks. I don't even, just weird looking deep water shark things, which were bastards to unhook.
And you just like winch them up.
Yeah, as well. Yeah. So the first thing I wound up, I did like a manual wind on a shark, and. It was quite a big shark, and we thought we were wrong. Like, fuck you, yeah, this is mean, but no, we weren't. It was shit. And then the boys turn up on Trout turns up on Man Cave, and oh, yeah, this is Trout from, you know, like last episode I did. And he pulls up in his boat, man cave. He's got none of these like fancy electric reels. They've got no sounder, so they're just fishing next to us because we told them that's where they were supposed to fish. Because, well, he's got a sounder, but his sounder doesn't go to 300 meters deep, which, to be fair, who the fuck needs a sounder that goes to 300 meters, you know? Like, and he just starts pulling up blue nose, like, not massive ones, but, you know, I've never caught a blue nose.
Well, and he's like 20 meters.
Like doing the same drifts, using the same bait, doing the same drift. Like, and I think they pulled up like two blue nose and three harpooker or something. And we just pulled up a bunch of sharks. And at the end of the day, Tom pulls up one harpooker. It was like big enough for a feed. And then we just.
Just been grinding.
Packed it up and drove 20 km back to the shore with our tail between our legs. And but I still had an absolute blast, to be fair. Like, I guess it's kind of goes back to what you're saying before, because it's like my first time doing it. Just anything excites you. So I'm down there and I'm like, oh, we get to press the button to bring up the winch, you know, and we pull it, we've got a fish. Well, it's just a shark, yeah, but it's a fish. Like, I'm excited, you know.
It's my first
exactly. So no, it was a good day, a couple of beers in the sun and whatnot, new near cruise time, but gonna have to go and do that again, I think, and try and actually do it successfully. But a bit of a different kind of a day of fishing, like, you know, just very relaxing and whatnot, compared to like if you're out like top water or jigging or something and you're looking for kingies, like, it can be fucking pretty on if you get on to the kingies, you know, whereas this was pretty chill.
Yeah. So, it's a good way to just, like, catch up with you.
Yeah, right, exactly. Exactly.
Just go out and have a yarn. And
there was plenty of yarns and plenty of bullshit. And, you know, it was a good time.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just like a loose, an excuse to just kind of sit around.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, it'd be kind of weird. It's like, hey, man, do you want to go, like, sit around a coffee table and chat? Like,
nah,
I don't really.
Nah, but if
that.
I put you on a boat,
like, hey man, do you want to go sit? Yeah, let's go sit on the back of the boat and just like watch the end of the rod tip for a little bit, change baits every momentarily. It's like, oh yeah, I'll throw down on that, you know.
Yeah, it's like I remember sitting one night when we were in Canada, me and Luke were just sitting there in this single cab truck. We had a rifle and a box of piss, and we'd just like driven out to this field to see if we could shoot a wolf or a coyote or something. And I don't think either of us picked up binos the whole time. We just drank beers and talked shit for a couple hours and then drove back home. Like, it's just, I guess it's the same as like when the girls go out for brunch, the boys just go out like fishing or shooting or whatever, you know. It's the same sort of thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just got an excuse.
Yeah.
Just an excuse for a yarn. It's like a loose framework.
No, and you can't complain with a good yarn. And I think that's like something cool about doing this podcast. Like, it's literally just spinning yarns.
Yeah, just good to have a yarn. It's like having a durry, you know, it's like it'd be weird to just loiter outside by yourself, wistfully looking off into the distance.
Yeah, but if you've got a dart,
but as soon as you're outside, like, punching a dart, yeah, they're just like, oh, he's having a dart.
Like, yeah, if you think about that, like, if somebody, you know, if somebody's like writing a book or something, and then there was a tall man, dark hair with a blue coat, standing outside, Mulder in his hand, smoldering away, pondering off into the distance, or there was a bloke outside just standing there.
Standing there watching the rain fall.
Yeah, like, what a it's fucking like, weirdo.
Oh yeah, one's got like significant mental illness and the other is just like, just getting a bit of peace and quiet, you know, just out there relaxing, punching a fan.
Shit. I listened to a really good podcast recently on anti-poaching in Namibia, they were talking about rhino horn and how for some reason, the horn. So the horn is worth something like 40 times that the rhino is worth some 40 times more dead than it is alive. Like you can buy a rhino for like 10 grand, but if you were to buy as much horn as a rhino could grow in its lifetime, it'd cost you like $200 million or something. And
Wow.
they were there was a big discussion. The guy had a big discussion around like changing the way we see the rhino trade and trying to make the rhino trade, the rhino horn trade legal to then change the way rhinos are valued. And then if we actually valued the live animal more, we would then grow, like we would keep the live animal.
Oh, so like growing rhino horn.
Yeah, and like so they got these rhinos at the moment and they like they go out every year or two and cut the horn off them so that you know they're not worth killing
Yeah.
for the black market or whatever. But if you just had a live rhino and you let it grow and then you cut its horn off it, which doesn't hurt it. It's keratin. It's just like cutting your hair or cutting your fingernails. Like you just grow this thing and then you cut it off. And like what you could then do with that horn and the fact that they've got like, because they dehorn all these rhinos, they've got like tons of rhino horn just sitting in Africa and all these different countries of Africa that can't be traded internationally, but they're just sitting in storage. And it's like, why not sell this stuff
Yeah,
to them?
this is just
Like,
a classic.
oh yeah, like, I mean,
It's a classic example of how like prohibition actually like can create more problems than what it's trying to solve.
yes.
Like exactly this. Like if someone was allowed to farm rhinos for profit, then capitalism would kick in and they'd realize it's like, oh, this is like it's illegal to hunt them, but I can farm these. I can buy them for 10 grand and then, that thing after cost is going to make me 100 grand over its lifetime of profit after like the cost of feeding and stuff. And it's like, oh yeah, there's like a business case there, and some geezer will do it. But it's, yeah, often the case where like regulation and prohibition, creates the problem that it's trying to fix in the first place. Because yeah, exactly that. If they created A, if they were able to flood the market, that would drop the price. And so it reduces the incentive for these people to like go out. And you can't blame the hunters. Like if some geezer's trying to feed his family, I think you look anyone in the eye and they're and listen to them say, yeah, I'm just trying to feed my family. Trying to put food on the table for my kids. They're gonna try and go and shoot these things. And so you can't blame the hunters. There's no point trying to manage the hunters because they're living in a world of how do I feed myself this week? How do I pay the bills this week, kind of thing. But if you can take the money out of it by flooding the market or allowing farms to be set up. Someone said it to me years ago. It's like there'd be, I think it was about kiwis or something. It's like if we're allowed to eat them, then there'd be no shortage
No,
of
I
them.
think this is probably something I said to you because I've had this like, and like, hear me out. Like, people are going to get up in arms about this, but well, maybe let's back off on the kiwis for a minute, and we'll just go with like with the pigeon because I mean they look tasty as hell. But like, imagine if we sold in the same way that like some countries or states and American stuff will like sell a tag for. What if we sold like five pigeon tags for the year and you could come, you like market these to the big.
Pay a
what you've got to do, if you can get the kiwi on a fucking, if you can get, so like in the States they have like the Grand Slam, which is like to shoot the four sheep, the four North American bighorn sheep, and then you've got the, like the Super Slam 25 and the this and that and the other. There's like a World Turkey Slam and shit like that. There's a list of things, and if you shoot them all, you get a little ribbon you can put on your bloody, on the side of your blazer or whatever. So if we get like a bunch of native bird, like if you had the Flightless Birds Slam or something, and you had like a couple of birds or something, or the Kiwi Birds Slam, there's a few birds, some flightless, some flighted, and you like sold, you marketed this thing as like, this is the next big trophy hunting thing that you have to have. And then all these like rich ass Americans and European guys and stuff, they'll be like, oh, we want one of those. So they'll pay horrendous amounts of money to get these things. And then imagine, like, we've got enough kiwi. We could lose one kiwi a year if it meant that we'd get bloody $50,000. I'm surely, you know, or whatever the number is, I'm sure somebody at DOC can punch those numbers and come up with a figure that's going to be beneficial for us. And we'll just go knock off a kiwi once a year or something.
Yeah, and yeah, we use kiwi as an example, but like that could work for, and I guess this is the whole argument in Africa that they have, where there's like the anti-hunting crowd. You know, it's like, how can you protect an animal when you're hunting?
Yeah.
So yeah, you know, on the face of it, I get that.
There's a lot more to it there in the depth of what that actually brings for the species.
Yeah. It's the difference between protecting individual animals, which if you're trying to protect individual animals, then it's like, no hunting. But if you're trying to protect the species, then, you know, it's like, okay, we can trade out some of that species, which aren't adding value to the population. So like, let's say surplus males.
Yeah.
We can trade them out for a sizable bucket of cash, which can then pay for rangers and whatnot to
do conservation work. Yeah.
So to protect the species overall.
There's a really cool quote.
Yeah, it's an interesting
from, that comes to mind from Stephen Ranella, the meat eater. He says, I like the deer, but I appreciate I like the individual deer, but I appreciate the idea of the deer more than the singular deer itself. And
yeah,
so you can, like saying that, you know, you can kill one of these animals within the species as long as your focus is on the greater good of that species and what you could, you know, as long as you're keeping in mind that greater, bigger picture of the species and what you can do for them. But,
Because it's that whole, like, oh, how can you kill something if you love it? It's like, I like deer
as a whole,
as like a collective,
than as that a collective singular term. Deer that I just killed.
And it's like hunting the deer is like a way of interacting with it, you know. And if you're not doing that, then you'd have no interaction with it.
That podcast I listened to for reference for this was the Into the Wilderness with Byron Pace. And it was episode number 227, From the Front Lines, with Alex Olofs. Yeah, it's one of those weird Afrikaans names that I can't really pronounce, I suppose. But that was very interesting. I'll put a link for that below. I'll send that through to you as well, Jace. It was a bloody good listen.
Yeah, it sounds good. Yeah. It's a whole I'm quite interested to read that book that you were talking about at the beginning.
Use Enough Gun,
So what is it? Use Enough Gun. Because I've found in my, the kind of like evolution of hunting that I'm interested in, started with, you know, what did it start with? Like Outdoors with Jeff. You know, like the original, like hunting shows in New Zealand, hunting Aotearoa,
Gone fishing.
and then, yeah, just like that early stuff. And I was only ever interested in watching New Zealand related hunting. I think, like, you know, back in the day when we were working on the dairy farm, there was like the Life's at Four DVDs and stuff. You know, and so I was only interested in seeing stuff in New Zealand, and then, you know, you'd see like snippets online, like YouTube, of people hunting whitetail, and I was like, oh, that just doesn't like scratch my itch at all. But I find it interesting that now,
There's more of that.
as I kind of understand it more, it is becoming more interesting. You know, and like watching the meat eater, and how kind of informative that is. And then understanding a bit more about hunting over there and talking to you about your time as a guide and stuff.
It's
Like
definitely
it.
like going that time I spent in Canada, like thinking about the way their system works. Well, that was just within BC, but like I know what you mean. Like when I was younger, like I didn't care. Like I just wanted to do the whole New Zealand thing. And then now, like the more you learn about it, the more you want to learn about it. When it comes to like the cool overseas stuff that we have now and that was there in the past, and the likes of the stories from Use Enough Gun.
Yeah, like it becomes more interesting as you understand more about it and have a bit of extra, bit more context. And then, because the reason I brought this up was, like, I've always thought that, like, hunting in Africa just, you know, it just, like, it does nothing for me. Like, it doesn't seem like.
Like you don't,
Like
you're
I
not
never,
interested in going over there for a hunt.
no, I like
Or
I'm not. But the reason I'm bringing this up is that, you know, as we've been talking about, it kind of makes me realize that, oh, you know, I thought I wasn't interested in going in there for a hunt, but now that we've, you know, we talk about it a little bit, and it makes me realize that, you know, where I am at with hunting in Africa is probably where I was at with hunting in North America 3 years ago, you know, and 3 years ago I didn't really know anything about it, and so it didn't interest me. And so it's probably the same thing. I just don't know anything about hunting big game in Africa, and so it does nothing for me out of ignorance.
I see. I think I'm kind of the opposite, that the mystery of it is part of why I want to do it. Although maybe, I don't know, because I also kind of don't want to do it in that I read these stories of like Robert Ruark, Use Enough Gun, and I know that if I was to go and hunt Africa, I'm not, like he's going on safari for like a whole month, him, his missus, and this dude called Thomas Selby, and they're just like heading off, going from village to village across Kenya, just camping out. I don't know, like
Yeah, it's not really
I
like
don't
that
think it's
anymore.
like that, but maybe it is and I just don't know, but it doesn't, I'm pretty sure that's not sort of what you're getting yourself into. And so there's part of me that feels like if I was to go to Africa, I'd feel disappointed in that I wasn't getting that story. But then
Yeah, true.
there's like the rest of me is going like, don't be an idiot, like you'll have the time of your life. So it's definitely a place on the list of cool things to go do.
Even going on safari there would be pretty sick.
Yeah, even just
Like I was
camera,
on
you're
like,
just doing like a photographic thing, eh?
yeah, like I went to Sri Lanka in 2018, and lived over there for a few months, and my folks visited, and we went down to the south of to like the southern end of Sri Lanka. And kind of did a little safari, and it was epic. Like you go out and see, yeah, there was like elephants, and we didn't see any, but there's like Asiatic bears and leopards,
Just crazy
and
shit.
yeah, just like it's just so cool to see. And I can't really imagine, like, just going back to use enough gun, like I can't really imagine rolling around on foot in that kind of environment.
Oh, when he talks, like, he describes in detail hunting for buffalo and how they'll, like, see a herd far off. They drive around to get in front of the herd with the truck, and the truck doesn't stop. The truck slows down, and he just jumps out with rifle, and the truck continues to drive off and then stops somewhere miles away as to not disturb the herd, because the herd wasn't concerned if the vehicle just drove past.
Oh, because they're kind of used to that.
So then he just, like, rolls out, and then he'll, like, walk 5Ks through, like, lion and creepy critter infested, like, tall grass, then crawl another kilometer just to get in on a buffalo to potentially not shoot it because it's only 43 inches and not old enough or whatever. And it's like, yeah, I don't know. I just find that like a mind blowing concept. Yeah.
Yeah. I honestly, I just can't imagine what it was like.
Yeah. Hey, we better wrap it up there for the night, bro. But man, this has actually been a bloody good yarn.
Yeah, sounds good.
You got anything you want to add?
No, mate, just good to catch up and, you know, hear about your recent trips. There's a whole nother piece that we haven't. I'm always interested to hear about you, what you're doing for work.
Oh, I promise you, it's not that exciting. Save
for another time,
but yeah, I mean,
no, we got to leave something.
Yeah, and yeah, actually, no, always good. We should have another yarn soon to talk about. I'd be keen to have a good yarn about your new bit of land on Great Barrier and what your plans are with the whole planting of trees and wildlife and whatnot around there, because I reckon that's badass as fuck.
Yeah, it's an exciting little project.
But
keep me busy.
For now, we'll call it at that, eh? You have a bloody good night. Thank you very much for doing this again with me. Yeah.
Sounds good.
Cool. Hooroo.
Cheers.
Well, with that, there goes episode 8. I hope you enjoyed it. As always, please do us a favor. Give us a rating on the old iTunes or Spotify, wherever you listen to it. Give us a subscribe or a follow or whatever the buzzword is. And maybe share it around. Show a mate. The more people that listen to this, the cooler guests I can get on, the more I'll actually do this, because I'll have more people bugging me, when's the next episode. And plus, it's just nice if you can help me out. Maybe I can help you out. So, yeah, give it a like, a follow, a subscribe, whatever the word of the day is. Ratings, reviews, those things are good. 5-star ones, of course, because we are outstanding. And, yeah, hope you enjoyed it. I do have another one lined up that hopefully I'll be recording later this week. So that'll be coming out soon. And then there's another two people, one of which I've been bugging her. I'm trying to get her on. She reckons she's not my girl. I reckon she is. So keep an eye out for that. And yeah, have a great day.